Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. All right, well, if you don't mind, this has been really interesting. I find it in many ways compelling. Do you mind if I close just by maybe making this a little bit, I don't know, I just want to ask you some questions and push back a little bit just to kind of have a discussion, okay?
Okay.
So, first of all, you know, I think we already started with the idea that one of the benefits of science is that it acknowledges that at any point in time it could be wrong, right?
Yes, that's a key feature. Actually, there's a word for it called tentativism, is that, you know, nothing is for certain. Everything is just tentative until better evidence comes along and overturns it.
So you acknowledge that all this falls under that, you know, category of tentative, right?
Oh, I could be wrong about everything I've discussed, okay. And I would welcome the opportunity to be corrected by people.
Okay, good. Okay, so let's begin by just talking about, you know, sort of from a pragmatic perspective. you know, you talk about evolution, and you not only talk about biological evolution, you talk about social evolution. And that you sort of value, you think evolution is what's driven, biology to arrive at humanity, which is a more advanced, sophisticated sort of form of biological being, right?
Yeah.
And in the same way, if you look at social evolution over time, you know, it seems like we've gotten less barbaric over time. It seems like we've gotten more fair over time, more just as a society in the whole over time. And and religion has sort of been with us every step of the way. Like, you could you could argue that if religion was not adaptive, that it would that it would have died off really early. But instead it's sort of, in many ways, it's stronger in 2012 than it was in 1915. Like, in some ways, the 21st century and the 20th century has seen an increase in religiosity on a global scale. Although I know that there's a growing group of secular people too. But I'm just saying, can you acknowledge the value and the goodness of religion to individuals and a society?
In a sense, yeah, you know, it's a part of who we are. You know, we can't help but perceive the world this way, and it's a defining feature of our culture. So the key word for this is that it's for better or for worse. You know, I don't want to say all religion is bad and terrible. It's the only thing I really want to pick on is the idea where you start, like I said before, you know, generating those beliefs so strongly that you start ignoring reality ignoring facts.
No, I get that point, but I'm asking you something very specific. Isn't there good evidence that religion is adaptive?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So positive, right?
And by positive, you mean in the sense that it's going to adapt to for the better, in the sense? Is that what you mean?
That it's been a component to our advancement as a more sophisticated society.
So you're saying, is religion itself the driver of advancement?
A driver.
I would say it's more of a product of our advancement. That is, at the end of the day, all that matters is how good can your group compete against other groups. And whatever beliefs, whatever traditions you have, whatever faculties you have for working together and overcoming obstacles and prospering as a culture, that is all that matters at the end of the day. And religion doesn't care if it's barbaric or saintly or just. All that matters is how well can you compete against the other groups and generate new members of your culture.
But could you say that the groups with the better religion perhaps did better than the groups with the inferior religions?
you know, I have to tread lightly on this, but in a sense, you know, there is a lot to be said for that. For example, one argument I've seen is the idea of why did monotheism beat out polytheism so quickly?
Right.
And one argument I've heard is that monotheism is a powerful tool for building national cultural identity.
Right.
Which is a, yeah.
Okay. So, and show me the atheistic society that has achieved social and cultural domination.
I believe there's a few in Europe that are really pushing that way. You know, Sweden and Denmark are some of the most secular cultures in the world. I can't cite specifics, but I do know there are at least some cultures where secularism is like the vast dominant, you know, 50, 60, 70% of the population.
But that's a recent trend, and yes, it's hard to say how that, whether that's going to lead to extinction. You know, you could argue that in Western Europe, within Western Europe, the religious immigrants who are becoming more populous are in some sense infiltrating these societies, such that at some point these groups like Sweden and Denmark and Norway, that have sort of, you could argue, have been protected by, you know, United States and Great Britain as more religious societies. If at some point these protective countries become more secular and don't be as protective, there's a chance that these Western sort of secular societies are going to get overtaken by the religious minorities, right?
Yeah. Secular doesn't automatically mean better or more suited to long-term survival and propagation. It just is what's happening right now. And as time goes on, we're going to see how well it competes against other cultural phenomena. We might very well see this rise of secularism all of a sudden just get squashed out when some big cataclysmic event shakes up the world economy, maybe.
Right.
You know, that might drive things up. You might just see maybe secularists will suddenly just give rise to the next Hitler by sheer fluke, and then all the more religious countries will just gang up on them and stomp it out. Or we might see the exact opposite happen, where some very religious country might do exactly that, and the secular ones will wind up dominating. It just depends on how, it's not just the secularism itself, it's how do you propagate that? You know, are you instilling that into your children? Are you pushing it on other people? Or are you more just content to live the way you are? And, you know, how strong are you in that belief? How much is it ingrained in your identity? You know, all of these things come together to determine how long that cultural idea will survive.
Right. And my only point is that there seems to be pretty good evidence that religion has been an important component to our advancement as a species.
I won't dispute that. I should say it's part of who we are, is to see the world in, as I said, to look for the agents in the world. And that religious belief is just a reflection on that throughout our history.
But maybe it's been a part of our success.
In a sense, yeah, it would be very naive to think that this religious idea would just sit out there in a vacuum and do its own thing. It has to intertwine itself in our success somehow, which means it has to adapt itself to either facilitate that success or it dies off.
Right. Okay, so the second thing I wanted to say is that, you know, it's pretty clear from the psychological data that I've seen that overall religion has a protective psychological effect on its adherence, that overall, on average, you're happier, you live longer, you're healthier if you are religious on whole. Would you concede that as well?
Honestly, no, I would not. A great sort of counterpoint to that is something like, consider the prison populations are predominantly religious in comparison with the sections of the population. Secular people are less likely to, at least in America, secular cultures is far less likely to produce things like teen pregnancy and divorce. So in a sense, you know, some respects you're probably right, but in others it's very not true. And the question is, you know, what do you ultimately value most? And how do you measure happiness and prosperity in this regard? Because you can make a case in many directions one way or the other. It's not just religion or secularism itself. It's really, you got to step back and just see culture as a whole.
Okay. And all
is that,
I'm
is that a fair response?
Well, yeah. All I'm saying is I can't. I'm not going to claim to be an expert in the literature, mm-hmm. but I have read a fair amount on the psychological and health benefits of religious participation and belief. And my take from the reading is that there is consensus in the literature that overall, I'm not saying that, you know, religious, you know, the religion never produces criminals. I'm saying that overall, religion appears to have a statistically significant psychological and physical health benefit to both belief and participation. And you know, it's hard to break that down. How much of that is the social benefit? How much of that is just positive thinking? How much of that is, you know, the moral values that get reinforced? You know, but I'm just saying, if you don't want to concede that, I just want to sort of make the assertion that that's what I've understood from the scientific literature. And maybe
and sort of a supplemental point to that would be, you know, what if believing in your faith made you nauseous? You know, if you grew up as, you know, religion A, and every time you went to church, you just wanted to scratch your eyes out, and then you go to your buddy's church and it's actually a fun social event, you know, you're going to gravitate towards the thing that is more beneficial. So the kind of supplementary point to that is, religious belief has to fulfill us in some way, otherwise it wouldn't
right.
be here.
That's right. Okay, so so I think we're on the same page. And I'm not saying that there aren't bad things. I am not saying at all that religion is never responsible for bad things, or that religions don't harm individuals. I'm just talking about the overall impact to both individuals and society seems to so far have been, on average, favorable and adaptive. And you know, so I guess what I'm going to say is, you know, as a member of the human race, as a member of the human species or whatever, as someone who probably, I'd say, cares about, you know, humanity, do you ever worry that teaching things that would cause people to question or even undermine their religious beliefs would, in a sense, be harmful to either individuals' psychological well-being or to humanity's well-being?
So that's an interesting question. You know, is it really in our best interest to make a case for secularism or not? You know, maybe we're inadvertently going to wind up destroying ourselves culturally.
Or
is that kind of what you're saying?
Or individually? Yeah.
I would say, in personal experience and from what I've seen, the answer to that is definitely no. Because most people, secularists I meet today, are way more happy in their secularism than they are in their prior religious life. So at least in the short run, from most people I've seen, they feel better off once they finally stop believing so strongly. But on the other flip side of that, there is, you know, a lot of social consequence that comes from giving up a spiritual belief, because it's so ingrained in culture and conformity. Because again, you know, a key to human survival and human perception of the world is this overwhelming drive to find other people and work together with them, because our survival depends on that. So our brains are really not well suited for solitude, in a sense, for rejection from groups. You know, that is something that really can crush a lot of people. So that is something I've also seen when people leave their religious faith, is they get crushed socially because their social groups reject them. So it goes a lot of different directions. Some people are better off when they leave. Some people generally, you know, suffer in other indirect ways. But overall, I've never really met anyone who's genuinely sorry if they've left their faith. And one thing, you know, to realize is you don't actually have to leave your faith in the end of the day to be secular. At the very least, I would say just recognize it for what it is. It's a cultural phenomenon that gets people together and working together and cooperating for survival and their benefit. The only danger is when you start overriding science. You know, the only thing I've bolded here in red on this slide here is this idea of generating convictions without regard for rigorous empirical evidence or rational skepticism. That is, when your cultural beliefs start trying to override reality, that's the only part where you start really facing danger. And not just like danger in terms of personally destructive, but like destructive to the group itself, because you start ignoring reality. You generate a culture that doesn't care what's real just has to affirm its belief no matter what. That's self-destructive.
Got it. Yeah, and the truth is, I have felt a consistent antagonism towards science from my early years in the church. You know, and I felt it not only in seminary growing up, but also at BYU. Yes, there were pro-science professors, obviously, and even pro-evolution professors like Bill Bradshaw. But in general, because of science's questioning of the age of the Earth, because of scientists questioning, you know, the literality of things like Adam and Eve, or, you know, Noah's Ark, or Jonah and the whale, or, you know, other types of things, evolution, I've always felt like religion has a somewhat hostile relationship towards science, and frankly, that whenever religion and science have come into conflict, that it's usually religion that ends up retreating. So I acknowledge the dangers of what you're saying.
And I'd actually even add one key point. You know, remember what religion is. It's a cultural phenomenon that has to adapt to its environment in order to survive. You know, what would religious belief like if the Catholic Church still held to geocentrism?
Right.
You know, it'd be a laughing stock today. Yeah. And, you know, that's the idea, is religion's okay with adapting itself to suit the environment. Science is just a hard, never-ending drive to figure out what's real. And that's why you generally see religion retreating, because it's more than happy to adapt.
Yeah.
Because it, by its nature, that's what it does. And science just every now and then drives onward and steps on the toes of a few cultural beliefs about the world. And then eventually, when people realize that that belief is probably kind of silly, they just give it up, and for the sake of the cultural and the identity and the survival. So it, just like you said, religion retreats because it's more than happy to. It's in its nature to adapt, whereas science is not really a cultural thing. It's a process.
Got it.
Yeah.
So here's the next thing I wanted to talk about. It's kind of around epistemology. What you'll often hear from religious people, and you know, Dan Witherspoon sort of represents this class of people within Mormonism more than probably anyone else I know. It's this idea that you know, you can know, you know, certain things empirically, scientifically, but there's also just this gut feeling or essence that there's more to life than what science can explain. And it's, you know, maybe love would be a metaphor for that. You know, you could reduce love down to the hormones and the chemicals, but there are many humans who just have this sense that love is something bigger than what science will ever be able to fully or adequately explain. And they would say the same thing about religion, that sometimes you get promptings, sometimes you get a sense of fulfillment or awe or majesty, or even of sort of influence in the universe that is that will always be meaningful and uplifting in ways that science will never be able to replicate or capture adequately. And so given that, there's a lot of people that say science, do whatever you want. There's this realm of knowing and of believing and of feeling that religion has the corner on, and it's tapping into something, and we shouldn't invalidate that different type or way of knowing in an epistemological sense. You know, there are plenty of believing you know, religiously believing scientists that say, yes, I respect science, and I'm still religious. And what would you say to those types of people who want to say, let's have both? Let's have all of science, let's have the best of science, but let's not mock or discount or discredit genuine spirituality or religious belief, because that's a crucial component of what makes life meaningful, what makes life interesting, what makes life enjoyable and worth living, and in some sense makes it healthy and beneficial.
Oh, gee, that was like a 10-part, where should I begin? The first thing I would really want to just take issue with is when you said how like science is not fulfilling. And
okay, wait, I didn't say that. I didn't say that science isn't fulfilling.
All right, well, how did you put it?
I did say that there are ways of for many religious people, there is a fulfillment and a meaning and a purpose and an identity and a sense of strength that comes from religion that they're not able to find outside of religion. I was not saying that science is not meaningful, is not fulfilling, is not rewarding. That's not what I was saying. I'm saying that...
Or that science can't replicate that same experience, maybe?
Well, maybe science can replicate components of it. But I would say that there's many religious people who would say that science will probably never be able to replicate the totality of what is, for people, spirituality.
And yeah, I would personally take a lot of issue with that. Being a professional scientist and engineer myself, who's devoted a huge chunk of my life to just discovery, you know, there are a few things in this world that are as exhilarating as making a very profound discovery. And, you know, it's almost like being high in that sense when you've discovered something very crucial about the world that ties it all together. Understanding the world is a very powerful tool. It builds a great deal of confidence in yourself and your ability to handle events in life when you understand the driving forces that make them happen. So, you know, and just like the idea of like studying astronomy and learning about things like black holes and accretion and event horizons or relativity, quantum mechanics, these are extremely counterintuitive and bizarre things that have their own sort of majestic beauty in and of themselves. So it's kind of naive to say that science can't, you know, replicate a lot of these experiences that religion gives. You get a lot of the exact same experiences. And I would even go so far as to say personally that it's even better. It's more profound and life-changing and uplifting in the scientific realm. But that would just be my personal bias, of course.
Right.
What were some of those other points you made? You made a lot of points. Let's focus on another one.
No, I don't know that I was trying to make several points other than that people there's different ways of knowing. Some religious people have a sense that there's different ways of knowing, and you can know something spiritually just like you know that you should you know, choose a certain career or marry a certain person or or be a certain type of parent, and you know that spiritually, and biological or scientific or chemical explanations just don't quite capture the full essence of that way of understanding the world or being influenced
or motivated. Okay, yeah. What I was going to say to that is, if nothing else you've learned from this discussion, you should realize that a lot of those intuitive ways of viewing the world and perceiving it are great ways to be wrong about everything. I don't want to sound mean in that. You know, we've learned that people hallucinate. Hallucination is a regular, normal thing. We've learned that people are heavily biased just on what the people around them do. We've learned that your memory itself will update and change just based on what you need it to change into or what other people pressure you into. So a lot of these sort of intuitive epistemologies sound very tempting, but the thing to realize is, if nothing else, we human beings are very good at getting things wrong. And when you rely on these intuitive epistemologies, it's not that you're going to be wrong, you're going to find yourself believing whatever you want. And there's a difference between belief and knowledge. Okay, when you talk about belief, you can believe anything you want, but knowledge is an idea that genuinely reflects reality. And if knowledge is what matters to you, if you want to understand the world as it genuinely is, and not just trick yourself into believing something comfortable or popular, then you have to use scientific method, because we've shown that relying on all these intuitive epistemologies just gets you wrong all the time. It's an extremely unreliable way of figuring out the world. Now, if you want to use it as just sort of a cultural tool for building relationships and, you know, experiencing life, you know, that's fine. But don't step over the bounds and claim that you're privy to some special knowledge about the universe just because you feel warm and squishy about something. You know, that's not a standard by which we claim to know things. That sort of makes sense?
It sounds like you're saying that there's risk in sort of having a religious or spiritual worldview, in that it can cause you to think you're better than other people. It can cause you to ignore important evidence. It can cause you to base decisions on things that you think might be divine, but in reality might be, cultural or social, and that may not be to your ultimate benefit.
Yeah, that's a key word you said, is making decisions. You know, at the end of the day, we all want to make good choices that lead to good outcomes. And you can't generate good choices consistently if you don't know what you're doing. If you base your choices on assumptions that are wrong, then your consequences are not going to be very optimal. So, you know, I would say, again, you know, it's okay to build this cultural identity and have these experiences, but remember, at the end of the day, you know, we have to make choices, and if you want to make good choices, you have to make them on a firm understanding of the world. And as we've seen, you know, the natural human tendency of viewing the world is good in some ways and very bad in a lot of others. And science is a methodology. It's a tool designed to help us overcome ourselves, to not land in these traps that get us wrong about things. And so that's what I would say. I hope, if nothing else, you gain this appreciation for what it's trying to do. It's trying to help you understand the world so that you can make proper choices grounded in a correct understanding and not in some naive intuition.
Right, right. Well, let me flip it around. What would you say about someone who would say, I agree with that, but I also believe that trying to make all your decisions based on data and the most recent psychological component study, you know, is also a potentially dangerous and flawed way to live your life? That there are going to be crucial moments in your life where you don't have all the data, where you are going to have a certain set of feelings, and in some cases you may even feel, you call it intuition, call it instinct, or call it inspiration, you're going to feel this unexplainable, non-empirical desire to make a choice that you're going to say, that was the best choice I ever made, and it made no sense, but I made it, and I'm glad it's the best decision I ever made, and I made it based on all these sort of crazy, non-empirical, mamby-pamby, warm, fuzzy sort of things that a scientist might discredit, and that there's danger in looking at the world purely intellectually, purely rationally, purely empirically, because it ignores a really important human element, which is emotion and maybe even spirituality. What would you say about that?
There's two things I would say to that. You know, first and foremost, you're still a human being. You still have drives and you still have preferences. So, you know, you shouldn't make your choice of career based purely on what's going to make you the most money in the world, unless that is physically what makes you happy. You know, it's okay to look at yourself and say, what makes me happy? And then make your decisions grounded on just trying to maximize your own happiness and well-being. But you have to set a goal somewhere. The goal itself is completely arbitrary and whatever you want it to be. But the process for making good decisions to achieve that goal is gathering all the data you can and trying to make reliable predictions about what the consequences of your choices will be. So, you know, the second thing I would say is this idea of, you know, every time somebody makes some wild decision that turns out to be good for them, you know, there's 10 other instances where somebody did the exact same thing and wound up dying from it, or, you know, having it completely blow up in their face or things like that. So, you know, you can't cherry pick, you know, individuals who wound up getting lucky in some, you know, gut decision. And because, like I said, every time somebody does that, there's going to be 10 other people who just completely fail at it. And but also, you know, don't forget that we are what we are, and we have motivations, and it's okay to make decisions based on what those motivations are. It's just make sure your goals are clearly defined and that your methodology for understanding the world and making good choices is clearly defined.
Okay.
Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, do you ever make decisions based on emotion or just gut or feeling?
Yeah, all the time. All right, and sometimes they work out great, sometimes and sometimes I regret them.
And do you like, you know, one thing the science will probably readily admit, and I'm aware of the flying spaghetti monster argument, but science will admit that it can't disprove the existence of God because you can't logically disprove the existence of everything, right?
It's called proving a negative.
Yeah, I'm not saying that that's a strong argument, but I am wanting to make sure that you agree that you can't disprove. And so my question to you is, do you ever wonder if there's more? Do you ever feel like there might be more? I mean, let's say an anthropomorphic God for you is off the table. Do you ever wonder? I mean, like, here's kind of what I've said in the past, that the idea that there's an anthropomorphic God seems absurd to me. It seems highly improbable, right?
Yeah.
But I also feel like there's just something in me, and it's just a feeling. Maybe it's these psychological components that you've described. But if I just try and look logically, it logically seems irrational to me that the splendor and the marvel that is the human existence, or even the natural existence, is purely some random, you know, inherently meaningless collision of particles that over a billion years resulted in the sophistication that is me and you having a language where we can relate to each other, communicate with each other over the internet, and that now 30,000 people are going to listen to our discussion, and all the complexities and advancements that went into all that. It just seems as illogical that is completely meaningless and random and just sort of random as it is that there's, you know, an anthropomorphic God. Do you resonate with that at all or not?
Yes and no. The first thing to remember is, think back to the very beginning of today's discussion. We saw an experiment where people are programmed almost, you know, physically to see the world as being designed. You know, people look at mountains and clouds, which are the spitting epitome of random conglomerations of atoms with no purpose at all, and people see design in that. And which means, you know, it's natural to want to look at the world and the majesty of it all and think, how could have it all gotten here? We also have to recognize that you're biologically hardwired to look at the world and see that, whether it's there or not. And that's kind of the danger you have to realize, is there is a piece of you that will look at anything at all and see that. And that's what you have to be careful of. You know, it's okay to feel it. It's okay to talk about it. But just don't take that step of saying that you actually know what the answer is.
Sure.
Or that it absolutely has to be, you know, and it's okay to feel that way. Like I said, you know, we all feel that way because we have to, as a byproduct of the fact that we need to recognize each other and work together. Yeah. So that's the key thing to realize. We all have sort of these innate intuitions about what seems logical or rational and the way it ought to be. And we all have that. We can't help it. And you just, the only line you shouldn't cross is this declaration that you know what that answer actually is. Because remember, again, need for cognitive closure. Some people are not comfortable with the idea of, I don't know.
And so,
you know, I don't know where the universe came from.
Right.
And so, and I'm okay saying that.
And so you called it, what did you call it with science? Uncertainty or hesitance?
Tentativism.
Yeah, you're saying that you seem to be saying that religion should also have a healthy dose of tentativism to avoid, you know, leading people to draw premature or unhealthy decisions.
I would even take it one step further and say everybody in every cultural context whatsoever should have a healthy dose of tentativism. Because we've been picking on religion a lot, but remember, this stuff applies equally well to things like political ideology.
Yep, that's right. That's right.
I'd even go so far to say, you know, whatever your political ideology is, you should have some tentativism buried in there as well, that you're not 100% sure and your views will change in light of evidence, not we should live in a hardcore, you know, fill in the blank of your favorite political ideology, and that's the way it ought to be. You know, be careful with that as well.
Okay. So given all this, I'll just ask this question in a slightly different way. Do you, James, still sometimes wonder or even believe in the possibility of there being a spiritual realm, or even of an afterlife? Or for you, is it a closed deal? Or do you have hopes or sometimes inklings in that direction?
Again, I have had those hopes and inklings since the day I was born. But the more I just study human nature and the ultimate nature of physics and the cosmos and how everything works together, I have never seen anything beyond that innate inkling.
What about and felt? Given what about felt?
Felt?
Yeah.
What do you mean by it? Have I ever felt like there was more? Or
some spiritual, some higher purpose. Some, you know, I believe that, like, you know, Mormon stories, which I think has helped some people, came out of some feelings that I got, you know, on a walk or sitting down in my basement. Just like, I feel like I need to do this. I feel like there's something prompting me to want to help these people and to do it. And maybe it's from a greater power. Do you today ever have feelings that way, that you are open to being from a higher or different, you know, non-material or non-logical empirical realm?
In a sense, yes. You know, I have all those same feelings and nuances that everybody else does. You know, the only thing that makes me different is the temperament to say, you know, is my gut feeling really a valid basis for saying I know anything?
Yeah.
And recognizing, again, my brain is physically hardwired to look at the world and perceive these things. Yep. And so you just have to be careful again. Yeah. Do your feelings determine this ultimate state of reality, or are they just you know, things you should embrace for what they are, but just be careful about making grand sweeping generalizations about the way things are.
Okay, and that's kind of that feels how I kind of describe myself. I don't know that there's a God. I don't know that there's a spiritual realm. It could be that when I die, that's it, and there's no meaning or purpose to any of this. But I kind of feel like there might be, and I've just found that living with that hope or with that sense of purpose and of inspiration just kind of so far has motivated me to want to do some things that I think have in the end been constructive and maybe valuable. But I'm very open to the fact that it could all be nothing and that it could be self-contrived. But I'm open. And it sounds like you're saying maybe you and I are somewhat similar in that respect.
Yeah, this actually boils down to the very first paper I cited in our entire interview is the relativity stuff. You know, it's okay to believe wacky things and to be open to that belief, but there's a price you have to pay before you can actually act on the assumption that this thing is true, and that is you have to demonstrate it in some capacity.
Okay. Well,
because if you can't demonstrate it, there's no reason to suppose it's actually there. That's kind of the ultimate take-home point.
Okay, so let's end. You know, you've sort of self-identified as a skeptic, as a rationalist, as you know, an empirical guy, as a scientist, and as kind of, you know, rejecting religion generally for you personally, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay,
yeah.
And there are stereotypes. There are stereotypes, you know, on behalf of religious people towards, you know, atheists and agnostics and secularists, you know, and some of those are that they're, you know, that life for them doesn't have as much meaning, doesn't have as much purpose, that maybe they're less moral and maybe they're just less happy people and that they don't have higher beliefs. They just sort of live in this sort of scientific, analytical, immoral malaise of sadness. And so what I want to do to close is have you, James, bear sort of a semi-testimony about, you know, what do you believe now? What are your morals? What are your values? And what's your level of happiness? And what are the things that you do believe in that inform and inspire you? And we'll just kind of close with that sort of secular testimony.
Okay. It's actually funny you mentioned morality, because I could do like a whole another hour long discussion about the cultural basis of morality itself. But, you know, what do I believe in? You know, some key things to realize is, you know, our lives are finite. Okay, you know, there's a huge, vast cosmic time that preceded me, and there will be a great big time after I'm gone. And this tiny little window is all I'm going to get, as far as I can tell. So that places an urgency to live your life as something fruitful and meaningful and really maximize the happiness you can get from it. Something that really sort of saddens me. I remember I had a discussion once about calculus. When I was first taking calculus, it was, you know, this great journey of discovery. I was learning this great new way to look at the world. And I was explaining it to some of my friends who were, you know, not really technical students. And, you know, I said, don't you want to learn calculus? This is great stuff. And the response was something to the effect of, you know, yeah, it would be nice to know, but I'll just wait till I'm in the celestial college and I'll learn it then after I'm dead, when it's more important and I have more time, in effect. And that really kind of broke my heart to see someone putting off this very, you know, uplifting, life-changing discovery of something like physics and calculus and the nature of astronomy and just saying, I'll learn it when I'm dead, was basically what it boiled down to. And I think that's an extremely terrible way to look at the world, is putting things off till after you're dead. That is, everything that's going to matter now, the matter in this world, is going to have to be performed today and now in your life. If you don't step up, no one else will. There isn't some ultimate guardian that's going to do things for us. The responsibility for making the world better rests on us and us alone. And I think that really motivates me to make the most out of my life, to discover the most I can, to live as best as I can, and make the most of a finite time that I have. So you talked a little bit about morality, and, you know, morality is a whole sticky issue in and of itself. And this might sound a little weird to some people, but I can honestly make a case. The ultimate standard for good moral behavior is your own selfish interest. And I hope that doesn't turn anybody off. But it turns out, you know, when you really go through the study of what it means to be a cooperative human being, that your well-being, your personal well-being as an individual, depends on the cooperation of others. You have to, as a matter of self-interest, get along with other people in order to benefit yourself. If you can't do that, your well-being in this world will suffer. And virtually all morality, from, you know, cooperation and generosity and gratitude and the golden rule, charity,
honesty,
yeah,
sexual morality.
A lot of these things stem from the fact that we have to get along with each other and form relationships, and that our happiness is very closely tied to the relationships we can build with others. So it's in your own best interest to get along and cooperate and do well by other people. That is what morality is a society and a group flourishing because the people are better at cooperating with each other and getting along with each other. So, you know, you don't need religion to tell you how to live with people. You just have to look at what seems to work out best for me and my group. And it turns out all these great traits of honesty and industry and, you know, a good study of ethics and discipline really are for your own benefit. So
you're not some immoral guy lying and stealing and sleeping with everything that moves. That's not how how your secularism plays out for you.
You know, this is an argument I hear, you know, without God, how can you be a moral person? It's kind of like saying, you know, now that God doesn't exist, why don't you just stab yourself in the thigh with the nearest sharp object? You know, how would that personally benefit me to just go rampaging around stabbing people and lying to them and murdering and raping? You know, all that would do is anger everybody and get them to retaliate on me and make my life miserable. It is my own self-interest that makes me a good person. And when you recognize it, I think you become a far better person because you understand what you're doing and why you're doing, and you don't feel constrained by some of the superfluous aspects of morality. So I guess, you know, a good example of things like, I know a hot political issue might be something like gay marriage. You know, what moral basis is there for banning homosexual relationships? So I know this is something I see a lot of Mormons and religious people really going back and forth on, is, you know, what is the ultimate moral basis for this banning of homosexual marriage? And it just boils down to a purely religious argument that you cannot force in a public sphere. And so, like I say, you know, giving up religion in a sense helps you shirk off some of those superfluous things of morality that maybe don't make sense and don't serve any cultural goals nowadays. So that's how I would describe my morality in a nutshell. Is just, you know, good virtue is literally its own reward. You do good for yourself by doing good with others.
Got it. So what do you believe in?
What do I believe in? I believe that there exists an external reality independent of our brains, and that we are, that our decisions have an influence on that reality, which can in turn affect our internal happiness and prosperity, and that you can't make good decisions unless you understand the world around you. And that scientific method is the only tool I've ever seen that genuinely helps us come to a firm understanding of reality and making good decisions that benefit us. is that a pretty good?
That's good. Good. I want to add something and then ask a follow up. But it's not just that there's a reality. We have an impact on the reality, and the reality has an impact back on us. And so, yes, understanding not only the reality that we live within, but also the role that we play in interacting and affecting the environment, that's a mutual reciprocal relationship that's crucial for understanding on both sides.
Yes.
And the extent to which we have ignorance on either side, either regarding our in ignorance or apathy regarding our impact on the environment, or our understanding of the impact of the environment on us, is the extent to which we probably live a suboptimal existence.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yes. Ignorance is not a good way to make decisions that benefit us.
So what do you believe in? What other transcendent things do you believe in? You know, things that are, that you would say, other than reality, you know, what are the things that sort of get you up in the morning, that get you excited, that make you want to, do you want to get married and have kids someday?
Oh, that's on the table, yes.
What's the point of it all? What's the point of it all to you? What's the point of living for you?
Because it's happy and serves my self-interest. And if I did not act in that way, then the cultural attitude and genes which define it will just die off and be replaced by someone else who does behave that way. And that's kind of what a lot of it boils down to, is, you know, if there's no purpose to it all, why don't you just kill yourself? Well, because if I believe that way, I'd kill myself and then just be replaced by somebody who didn't believe that way. And then he would be here and he would just act accordingly under his own interests. So, you know, what really drives me and gets me up in the morning is just life itself. The thought of getting out and discovering something new, the thought of experiencing new things, the thought of understanding the world and making a difference in it before I'm gone. Those are things that I believe in and that motivate me to do what I do.
Very nice. Well, I think that's a very nice way to end.
I hope that was very uplifting. Yes.
Yes, I'm inspired and uplifted in a very secular way.
Oh, good. Okay, good.
All right. Well, so first of all, Dr. James Nagel, I want to thank you for coming on Mormon Stories Podcast. Thank you.
And thank you for having me.
I want to encourage people to check out your YouTube site. I guess that's youtube.com/anticitizenx. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Check that out. I also want to encourage people to check out, you know, to continue this conversation on the blog, mormonstories.org. You can interact with James and ask him questions. He'll respond back, hopefully. And you guys can have a bit of a discussion about what you liked and didn't like, or what you thought about what we talked about. I want to, encourage everyone to keep listening. And basically, I want to thank everyone for their support. Those who are supporting Mormon Stories, just let them know that your support makes a difference, and it allows this all to happen. So thanks again for listening. James, thanks for coming on. And we,
thank
and
you.
We look forward to more good conversations in the future. So everyone take care. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far to drive, do this and joy. Your hearts will swell, oh, all is well, all is well. Why should we mourn? I think our lot is hard, 'tis not so. Journey's through.